Hello and welcome once again to Cooper Talks, and time for another exciting podcast. Although that's very presumptive of me to call it exciting, you may find it exciting, you may not. But today I'm going to be looking at the second Berlin crisis. So this is another episode in the Cold War series of podcasts. This is the second Berlin crisis, the first one back in 1948-49, the Berlin airlift, when Stalin closed access to Berlin to the west. This is the second one in 1961, and it involves the building of the Berlin Wall. So it's the Berlin Wall podcast, which links in with the previous ones on Hungary and particularly the Bay of Pigs, which is all sort of in the background to this. So I'm going to give you a run through of this particular Berlin crisis. Now, let's just have a think of what was going on, and let's go all the way back in time to Potsdam, where it had been agreed that Berlin would be divided into four zones, each controlled by one of the Allies. So France, Britain and America on the western side, and the Soviet Union on the eastern side, mirroring the split that happened in Germany. This was only meant to be a temporary situation, and obviously resulted from the alliances that had happened during World War II. Stalin tried to get rid of the Allies, this sort of western enclave of democratic capitalism behind the envisioned Iron Curtain, and that hadn't worked. And so that ended, the airlift ended in 49, and then West Berlin carries on being part of the Western sphere of the world. Yes, of course, in the American orbit and sphere of things. And following on from the Berlin airlift, we get a changing situation in Germany. And it's an interesting one. So it's worth bearing in mind that while in the eastern part, the communists viewed all signs of Nazism as irredeemable and basically expelled them all. And they could do that because they were imposing their own control on it. They basically replaced anyone with any association or link to the previous regime and imposed a new system of partisan communist alliances. And again, like I said, the Soviet Union could do that because it was making no bones about it. It controlled East Germany and East Berlin. In West Germany, it was slightly different. Although the three zones controlled by France, Britain and America were to be overseen by these three forces, none of them had an intention of remaining as an occupying force. Slightly ironic, and they did end up having troops stationed there on military bases, in some cases still do, but mostly right the way through the Cold War. But they didn't want to be occupying forces that actually controlled things, so they wanted to give power and control back to the Germans. The trouble was, everyone who'd been in any authority or any administrative position for the last 12 years or so almost certainly had a connection to the Nazi Party one way or another. So it's sort of an illustration of the Truman Doctrine here, that the Allies ended up kind of giving authority back to people that had at least associations. They might not have been high-ranking Nazis or even official members of the Nazi Party, but they basically gave authority back. And that's a whole interesting set of issues that played out for a long time afterwards. But nevertheless, the Western zones are being given greater independence. And eventually, Britain and America would say, hey, we're basically operating in West Germany and West Berlin in the same way. Let's unify our two territories here. We've got two zones. Let's unify them so they've got the same currency and they've got the same admin. They can be run from Bonn in West Germany. We'll call this Bizonia, because it's two zones. Very clever. Eventually, the French zone would join in as well. They said, hey, Trizonia is a bit of a crazy name. Let's call this West Germany. And basically created this Western state. Okay, the state of West Germany. Now, obviously, Stalin had tried to get rid of that. That failed. And West Germany had developed under martial aid and continuing American presence in West Germany to become an economic powerhouse and a success story for democracy. And this would be measured in West Berlin. Remember, there's a road connecting West Germany to West Berlin. And of course, the Allies, the Western Allies, can fly in their troops and equip it and resource it and fund it. Now, it wasn't by accident that the Americans made sure West Berlin was particularly prosperous. Okay, they wanted to put on display all the signs of capitalism's great virtues. So the shops were filled with consumer goods, there were luxury items, there were TV stations and TV broadcasts going on of American programs and luxury goods, etc. And a much, much higher standard of living. And this was because up until 1961, although each zone was controlled by a different sphere, East Germany versus West Germany, West Berlin was accessible. You could just walk from any part of East Berlin or East Germany that bordered West Berlin, you could just walk in there. Okay, so people would go backwards and forwards to the two. So worth bearing in mind, most of the traditional cultural stuff in Berlin, actually in the Eastern zone, things like the Opera House and so on, and the Reichstag for that matter, whereas the Western part, actually the Reichstag in the Eastern part? Anyway, that doesn't matter. But most of the interesting stuff's in the Eastern part, but the Western part had the wealth, so people travel backwards and forwards, and open access between the different zones was a key part of the agreements that came out of Potsdam. So that was all fine. The trouble was, it showed a direct contrast between East Berlin and communism and West Berlin and capitalism. And capitalism looked much, much better. Okay, for the ordinary Germans on the ground, it seemed to be much more successful and much more pleasant. Okay. This was compounded by East German opposition to some of the Soviet policies that had been introduced and developed throughout the 1940s and 50s. So one of the big ones was the imposed collectivization of agriculture. So this was following on from the policies that had developed under Stalin in the Soviet Union in the 1930s, very controversially in those times. And it had been imposed on East Germany, as it was on all Eastern communist states, and was all part of Comecon and the universal economic policy. However, German farmers resented this a lot. They obviously developed farming techniques, they'd been quite prosperous in the past, and they really resented essentially losing their farms and being made to work on a big collective with shared resources and so on. So this collectivization of agriculture was deeply unpopular in East Germany. Also, the East Germans, having been part of Germany and capitalism beforehand, supported and wanted private trade. And when that was banned, effectively, under the communist rule, that was, again, incredibly unpopular. And, as mentioned, the lack of consumer goods and the much tougher conditions in East Germany compared to West Germany, or certainly West Berlin, that was alienating a lot of German people. And a number of things sort of happen. Partly you get Stalin's death, and with Stalin's death, that's the removal of Stalin as a figure and the sort of, oh, what's going to happen next? You get Khrushchev coming along in 1956, allowing the Hungarians to reform, and Khrushchev saying he wants people to love communism, and this is part of his policy of de-Stalinization. He says, no, all that repressive stuff, that was really bad, let's have reforms. Okay, it's those things that led to the Hungarian uprising. And it's worth bearing that in mind, that was Khrushchev's whole mandate. He wanted the people to love communism, and he thought, if they just give it a chance, they're going to love it. And of course, that had been the justification for a lot of these Eastern European countries choosing, in inverted commas, to become communist after World War II, that communism was better and it was more popular. The problem was that by the late 1950s, it clearly wasn't that popular with the people of East Germany, at least. And the more they saw the contrast between West Berlin and the rest of Eastern Germany, people weren't happy. And because they could just cross in, they started leaving. Okay, they started leaving en masse. Hundreds of them would leave, just walk from East Berlin into West Berlin, and from West Berlin they could travel to West Germany, and effectively they've escaped communism. And hundreds of thousands of people were doing that throughout the 1950s. Now, that sends a really bad message about communism, not just in Germany, where people knew it wasn't doing as well, but to the rest of the world, because of course the Americans make a lot of play about this and say, see, communism's not that good. Where people are given a choice, they're coming to capitalism. And Khrushchev said, no, you're just bribing them with all these luxury consumer goods. They'll appreciate it once we've given it more of a chance. The repression of the Hungarian uprising kind of undermined that and led to an increase in people leaving East Berlin. And so Khrushchev's in a bit of a quandary here, because the existence of West Berlin and people leaving West Berlin en masse, I mean, the whole University of Leipzig maths department defected on one day, and actually the type of people that were defecting were the valuable type. Sorry, I mean, all people are valuable, so that's not the right time. But from an economic point of view, it was skilled workers, it was intellectuals, it was the people that you needed to develop infrastructure, to develop intellectual and engineering capacities and so on, not just people to do sort of day-to-day grind work. I mean, people who did those jobs, actually communism wasn't that bad, but people who could excel under a capitalist regime, they saw the opportunities being presented in West Germany as much better, and so they were happy to defect. So it's got the dual effect of undermining what's actually going on under communism, saying communism's rubbish, and it's also weakening East Germany economically, making it less able to compete with West Germany. It's also, I mean, another interesting one is, I mean, so that's going on throughout the 1950s, so interesting at all. So why does it come to a head in 1960? Why not earlier? Well, for a start, no one really wants a war over Berlin. Okay, and particularly over West Berlin. So, yeah, the Allies, you know, Eisenhower, as the representative of the free world, if we like, was leading America. He had other concerns. He was more bothered about the spread of communism in places like Vietnam and Korea and elsewhere. And so he was not looking to make any part of East Germany part of the capitalist sphere, and he was content to leave things as they were. And obviously it suited America's purpose because it made communism look worse. Khrushchev looked at it and he saw it as an irritant, but again, really didn't want to go to war. And he thought, if you go to war over this, then it kind of suggests people don't really want to be communist. And is this the issue we really want to do? And of course, Khrushchev has only really established his authority around 1956. So those first few years, he's trying to establish himself, and then he's trying to secure things and make people love communism. It's also worth bearing in mind that it's an interesting one, that West Germany eventually became a full-fledged member of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, in 1950. It was October 1954, so just over a year after Stalin's death, that NATO invited the newly recognized West Germany to join it. Stalin had been deeply opposed to this, and chances are, as long as Stalin was alive, there was no way they could risk West Germany becoming part of NATO. That could have led to a full-on war, but in the kind of temporary chaos that existed after Stalin's death, until Khrushchev emerged as the leading authority, the Americans and NATO took advantage, and East West Germany became part of NATO, invited in October 1954, became a fully fledged member in 1955. So again, that's also what triggered the final formation of the Warsaw Pact in 55. So Khrushchev is looking at this and goes, well, you know, if I attack West Berlin, or if I try and do something, that's going to lead to a whole NATO attack. I'm too busy. There's too much going on. West Berlin's not really the issue we want to fight about, even though it's embarrassing. But it was a problem nevertheless. Now, if we go to 1959, everything seems actually relatively positive between Khrushchev and Eisenhower. Both experienced leaders now. Khrushchev, it's a very interesting guy. Grew up in rural Ukraine, ended up becoming the mayor of Moscow and so on. And he loved the idea of travel. He wanted to explore the world, and he kind of positive in his way. So when the Americans invited him to America, he was very, very excited. And he loved going over and seeing the Statue of Liberty and traveling around Washington, D.C. This was in 1959, early on. It's where Khrushchev also first met Castro at the UN in New York, and that's where that relationship began. But they had lots of good times and fun. It all went well. And Eisenhower and Khrushchev both agreed to have a conference about nuclear weapons and Berlin. And said, well, you know, let's have a meeting. We'll maybe have a meeting in Geneva. We'll have some preliminary talks in Paris. But why not have a big arms summit? We both are spending so much money on this arms races, this nuclear war. It's too much. And let's sort out the conflict with Berlin. We know it's a bit of an issue, but no one wants to fight about it. All good, except, as those of you who've already listened to the Bay of Pigs podcast will know, sadly, on the 14th of May 1960, a U-2 spy plane gets shot down near Sverdlovsk in the Soviet Union. And this changes the dynamic completely. Okay, the Soviet Union were not at all happy bunnies about this. They put the captured pilot, Gary Powers, on public display, say, look, the Americans are spying at us. It's a betrayal of trust. I mean, the irony being the Soviets were also spying on America, but they weren't happy at all about this. They saw it as a humiliation. And of course, they want justice, as they see it. So Khrushchev angrily demands flights be stopped over Russia and that America apologize. As I mentioned before, Eisenhower very happy to stop the flying missions, but he was not prepared to apologise. So at the preliminary meeting in Paris, there were bitter exchanges and they argued over this. Eisenhower ended up cancelling his reciprocal trip to the USSR, and Khrushchev got angry and slammed his shoe down, and it all went very, very badly. Now, you might think, why didn't Eisenhower just apologise? Problem being, if he apologises, he looks weak, and it kind of suggests that what they were doing was wrong. Okay, so things rapidly deteriorate as a result of this during 1960, and all the hope of coming to a peaceful, negotiated compromise over Berlin fell out the window because of this shooting down of the spy plane. So things had also been developing in terms of West Germany getting stronger and stronger. So mentioned already, military in 1955, West Germany joined NATO, making it a real military threat now to the Soviet Union. Also means American troops and weapons and nuclear arms could be placed there. You also had in 1957, West Germany helping to create and establish the European Economic Community, along with Italy, France, the Netherlands, Belgium and Luxembourg. And this was seen as a real economic threat because as a free trade area, it would only become more wealthy and more prosperous and again stand in direct economic challenge to East Germany. And of course you have the brain drain with about 20,000 people a month leaving for the West via West Berlin. So it was becoming a major problem with the loss of labour, loss of professional and intellectual skills, and it all looks bad, okay, as well as a military threat from NATO and an economic threat possibly from the European Economic Community. But Khrushchev sees an opportunity because those Americans with their elections go and switch leaders. And in January 1961, JFK becomes president. Now, he comes in, he's young, he's inexperienced. Khrushchev says, right, I'm the seasoned person now. This is very different from Eisenhower. And then when the Bay of Pigs fiasco erupts, Kennedy is just made to look even weaker and inexperienced and indecisive. And Khrushchev says, right, I've got the measure of this young guy. I can intimidate him, okay? And so there's a Vienna summit held in 1961, again, principally to discuss Berlin and arms limitations. But Khrushchev again demands an apology, although not very strongly. But the key thing is he demands that Kennedy withdraw troops from West Berlin. And he thinks after the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy will be happy to take this as a win. Ho, ho, ho. Kennedy refuses. Okay. And actually, far from withdrawing troops, he actually pledges to increase defense spending in America by $3.5 billion. So actually, Kennedy's response, possibly because of the Bay of Pigs, he says, right, I've got to look strong. I've got to look tough. Early days here in my presidency. Boom. I'm going to stand up to Khrushchev. I'm not going to withdraw the troops from West Berlin. And I'm actually going to increase military funding. Now, Khrushchev is in a difficult position. He's basically given Kennedy an ultimatum. He said, withdraw troops from West Berlin or else. And Kennedy said, no, what are you going to do about it? So they're squaring off here. There's a real possibility that war might be triggered here. And of course, Kennedy saying no, what's Khrushchev going to do about it? If Khrushchev decided to force the troops out, then that's effectively a declaration of war against NATO, and we have World War III. So this was a big issue, and everyone was waiting to see what what Khrushchev would do. What Khrushchev ended up doing was building the Berlin Wall, effectively isolating them. So in 1961, I think it was around October the 27th, I may have made that up, don't quote me on that one. But in 1961, Khrushchev orders Walter Ulbricht, the ultra-hardline communist leader of East Germany, to cordon off West Berlin from East Germany with barbed wire. Okay, so they just put up the string of barbed wire with soldiers patrolling it, and in the following weeks they start putting up brick walls and cement barriers, effectively putting a ring fence or wall around West Berlin. Do remember that. It's a wall around West Berlin, okay? So it's basically fencing West Berlin away from East Germany. They close all the other crossing points, all the roads and access points that people could travel through. The only one that remained open between East and West was Checkpoint Charlie. That's one of the reasons why it became so famous. Right in the heart of Berlin, that was the only place you could go from East to West. The only gap in the Berlin Wall. So this gets built. Now, people realised what was happening, so some people tried to jump over the barbed wire before the wall was built. Others tried to go through buildings, because the Berlin Wall effectively went right through some buildings. So, which is kind of weird, but the Soviet Union basically said, right, no one lives in that building anymore, we're just walling it off, we're closing it off, we're bricking up all the windows. All of this was in their territory. They didn't encroach on any West German or West Berlin territory. It was pure on their territory. So again, there's not a lot America or West Germany could actually do about it, because if they start interfering in what's going on in East Germany, that could be seen as a declaration of war. So they just had to put up with this. And of course, this is devastating for the people of Berlin. Families living on different sides of the wall, who used to be able to go and visit each other quite freely, they are now separated and won't be able to unify again, not until the 1990s. Economically, well, it doesn't make that much of a difference, but of course, it does rapidly cut down the number of defections after the 1960s. Although people will still try, a lot of people will lose their lives trying to cross the Berlin Wall, and the Berlin Wall's security and measures are going to get stronger and stronger and stronger. Now, this has been Khrushchev's action. What does Kennedy do about it? The answer is there's not a lot Kennedy could do about it. Okay, if he tried to take on and fight the wall, it's an act of war against the Warsaw Pact countries, triggers World War III, and he doesn't really want to go to war. No one's ready for that at this particular moment. And he actually says, well, it's not ideal, but a wall is better than a war. And he's got a point with that one. So he kind of allows it to happen. There is a moment of great tension, happens a few days after the construction of the wall, where having been guaranteed free passage between East and West German, West Berlin, Walter Ulbricht, the very, very hardline communist leader of East Germany, actually put tanks and troops at Checkpoint Charlie to stop the Americans from entering and the West Germans. And the Americans put their tanks at Checkpoint Charlie. So there was a really close moment where the tanks, you know, were right opposite each other. And had there been some less cool heads than the officers on the ground there, then things could have escalated into a full-scale war. Eventually, rather than charging at each other, each side kind of shuffle back 5 meters at a time. It's kind of like one goes back 5 meters, another goes back 5 meters. So it's kind of like a reverse game of chicken. No one wants to be the ones to withdraw, because that would look like submission, but they kind of do it each one at a time until eventually the situation's calmed and Checkpoint Charlie will be manned, but people will be supervised and allowed to travel between East and West. Obviously that's going to be heavily restricted and so on. Khrushchev does pull Walter Ulbricht up and says, no, that's a bit too close. Don't be quite so strict with your military interpretations there. As for Kennedy, he basically says, well, there's not a lot I can do. He goes to West Germany, goes to West Berlin, and he says, oh, this building of a wall is a really bad thing, but don't you worry, people of West Berlin, I'm with you. I am a donut. He says, ich bin ein Berliner. Berlin is a type of custody, creamy sort of donutty type thing. But, you know, it's a great speech, and everyone went, yeah, he's one of us, he's with us, he's standing in solidarity. But in truth, it's very limited. And this internationally was seen probably as a win for Khrushchev. He'd stood up to Kennedy, or he'd given Kennedy an ultimatum. Kennedy had said, nope, I'm not going to withdraw the troops. Khrushchev said, fine, then we're going to build a wall to block you in, so to speak, to fence you off. From Khrushchev's point of view, he says this is purely to protect East Germany and East Berlin is from the corrupt and evil influences of capitalism and to avoid any spying, which, to be honest, was going on from both sides. So it's just a matter of protecting ourselves. The West Germans and Kennedy would say, well, hang on, this is more like, it's kind of a reverse prison wall. You're stopping your people leaving the country. That's what you're doing. Your people aren't happy. They want to come to us. You're stopping them. You're keeping them locked in. But that's about it, okay? The Berlin Wall will become a physical symbol of the division between East and West Germany. A physical symbol of the Iron Curtain, if you like. There never was an Iron Curtain, but the Berlin Wall seems to personify that. And it remains a sore point throughout the whole of the remaining part of the Cold War until it comes down in 1989. Thanks to David Hasselhoff, allegedly. More of that in a future episode. But it is worth just stressing, although kind of after that things just carry on, you know, it's just, oh, the wall's been built up. It had a real human cost for the people of divided Berlin. Yes, it stopped the brain drain, but again, it kind of built on Hungary and showed that people didn't really want to be communist, and the communists were having to take more extreme measures to make sure they remained in the communist fold. Beyond that, it actually showed to a degree Kennedy's weakness. And so following on from the Bay of Pigs disaster and then Kennedy's inability to stop the building of the Berlin Wall, it empowers Khrushchev or makes him confident. He thinks, right, I've got the measure of Kennedy. He's not going to stand up to me. He doesn't want to risk war. I can push him. And that is going to directly lead onto the next conflict, will happen in 1962, a year later, which is the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is for next time. Oh, one final thing, just thought I'd throw this out there. West Berlin will become kind of a jazzy art scene, and part of the reason for that, people wanted to go there because it was all risky, but also because a lot of young Germans, German men, had compulsory military service, but they were given the option that instead of actually having to go and do military training and all that, if you went and lived in West Berlin for 2 years to keep the population and everything up, then they would count that as your military service. So you've got a lot of young, arty and creative people avoiding the military and going and living in West Berlin. as well as artists and things from all over the year. So it became kind of a trendy, cool place for a while. And it still is, although East Berlin now is more where everything's at. Anyway, that's for modern times, and that's just my opinion. So that's the Berlin crisis. And it may seem like not much. You might say, well, they built a wall and nothing happened. But that confrontation at Checkpoint Charlie was pretty much the only time Soviet and American tanks or troops actually faced off against each other. And that easily could have been the spark or flashpoint that triggered a whole set of nuclear wars and nuclear war and, yeah, the end of everything. So although it might not seem like much, it came very, very close to a major crisis. And it kind of just set the division between East and West Berlin as permanent. In a sense, it did resolve that issue that had been left over from Potsdam, but it remained set until the end of the Cold War, or at least the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989. So that is the Berlin crisis. Very interesting, I like to think so. And I hope you found it interesting with lots of details and so on. That will be useful. The next episode, I shall be looking at the Cuban Missile Crisis, which follows directly on from this. So hope you're enjoying or getting some benefit, at least, from this Cold War series, and I will speak to you again soon. Take care, and good luck. Or just have a nice life. I really don't know how to end these things, so I'll just say goodbye.